All right, you guys. What questions do you have? I'm delighted. Anybody? Yeah, bro. I'll tell you a story. The question was asked about getting to Israel. There is a. I'll tell you a background here, just because it's a thrill. When I was at Master's College, where I met the Ballantyne kids and so on, I worked with a program sending kids to Israel for a semester, and it was so effective, but the program itself wanted some things, and so we started our own campus over there. And in the effort to establish a campus, it's a semester abroad campus where kids go. It's called IBEX. Look it up on the internet sometime. It's fascinating. But kids go over there and spend a semester. And it's a semester abroad program, and it's really been God blessed. And I needed to find a place to house those kids, to have a campus. And I insisted that it would be a turnkey operation. In other words, somebody else is running, we just rent some space. And the Lord led us to the most wonderful spot in all of Israel. It's called Yad HaShmonah, and it's a moshav. Now, do you know what the kibbutzes are, the kibbutzim? Are you familiar with that? A kibbutz is a cooperative, all right, got to back up one more step. When you had all of the Israel, even before Israel became a state, and then after, in the early days of Israel as a country, you had tens of thousands and millions of refugees coming from various parts of the world, and in many cases, they came with nothing but the shirt in their back. And Israel had to find ways to absorb those refugees. And one of the most effective was the kibbutz movement. And they would cede a piece of land to a group, and that group was responsible to pay taxes, and it's a heavy taxation. But the point is that they would absorb people, and they were called the kibbutzim, it's called a kibbutz, K-I-B-B-U-T-Z, which means collective. Because when you get there, you're immediately taken, you're given a place to live, your food is provided, your medical care, education for your children, everything, but you own nothing. And when you leave with the same. And it's entirely democratic in the sense that all decisions are made by vote. They meet in the dining hall, and what are we going to plant? Do we want to buy a new tractor? Should we, and everything is vote. And it was marvelously effective. Well, as time has gone by, those kibbutzim have really begun to struggle, and today they're almost dead. It's a huge issue and so on. But one of those, a moshav, M-O-S-H-A-V, is very much like the kibbutz, only it's not quite as collective. There are some personal possessions you can have. Okay, and you, by the way, on the kibbutzim, and this was hard on a lot of people, originally, basically, your children were raised by the kibbutz, and that's what really the moshavniks were, much more family-oriented and so on. Now, I say I just make the point that in the 70s, a group from Finland, believe it or not, a Christian group from Finland, went to Israel and started a moshav. And they were Jews, but they made Aliyah from Finland, and they were Christians, evangelical Christians, serious Christians. And in the course of time, a family named the Bar Davids, five siblings whose father had more or less given rise to the Messianic Jewish movement in Israel. Just a wonderful, wonderful story, how their father had come to faith, a European, very aristocratic Jew who had been trained by his parents in strict Judaism, never had any interaction whatever with Christians, had gone to Switzerland to do a doctorate in his 20s, and was remanded to a family that was very Jewish and don't have any interaction with. He was in a library, and he was just studying in that library, and he looked across, and there was a little book laying on the desk, a little black book. It was a New Testament. He picked it up. He read it again. He became a Christian. They did the whole funeral thing for him. He moved to Israel. This is in the 1920s, in the hopes that he would find some sort of Christian community there. What's he thinking about? He made his way to Bethlehem, where there was a little Arab Baptist college. He studied at that college. This aristocratic Jew, dispossessed of everything, studied this college. He became the father of the Messianic movement in Israel. He had a number of children. Five of them moved on to this kibbutz, or this moshav, and became part of the moshav. And today it's a wonderful, it struggles. They have their own set of struggles. But they love the Lord. They are mature, deliberate Christians. I'll tell you one other thing, and I don't mean this to be at all, I don't mean to make trouble here, but this is marvelous. They are not only mature, deliberate Jewish Christians, they're non-charismatic. Now, they're not anti-charismatic. But most of Christianity in Israel is wildly around the corner charismatic. I mean, Benny Hinn stuff. And these people are solid students of the Scriptures. They love the Lord. And that's where the IBEX campus meets. And it's been the most wonderful relationship for these 12 or 14 years the campus has been going. Now, that was not your question. They are always looking for volunteers. And if you know a young person, or if you are of an age and a status in life where you can do it, if you can get there, you have to pay to get there. Once you get there, they take entirely care of you. You live in the volunteer quarters. They're nice. They're not palatial, but they're nice. You work very hard. Their primary, every moshav slash kibbutz has at least one, and in many cases, two or three different industries. For a long time, their industry at this moshav, which is, by the way, the whole moshav is constructed of log cabins, which just knocks your eyes out. When you drive up in Israel, they're all Finland. I was there one time when they shipped in one of these pre-made, pre-cut log. I mean, it's just slot A and, I mean, tab A and slot B, and you got you a building. You know what I'm saying? I watched them, whack, 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 and it went up. And what they did for many years, they had the nicest woodworking in Israel. And they would sell this pine furniture because they got all this wood from Finland. They had this connection. Now, frankly, I mean, it's true everywhere. The Chinese can build furniture cheaper than they could, so they lost that business. But their primary business is what they call in that country hospitality, which means travelers staying overnight. And it's mostly Christians, but if a person goes there, my niece just got back. It was the most wonderful 6 months of her life. You can go for as little as 3 months, but you know, once you get there, they entirely take care of you. One of those Bar David families, the father is named R.E.A. Bar David. He's one of the best guides in the country. He's got a little institute. He invites you to sit in the classes if you're not working. IBEX is there. The classes, if you're free, they can sit in on some of those classes. They always develop good relationships with the IBEX students and so on. But you're going to, and REA will take them out on the weekends and take these remarkable hikes. You know, 1 week they'll follow the steps of King David when he was, or David when he was fleeing from Saul, and they'll spend the night in the cave of Machpelah, cave of Machpelah. Where did he, no, Adullam. David fled to the cave of Adullam, remember? And then he went down to Ziklag, and they'll walk that. They'll hike that over the weekend and so on. So they have a lot of very, they work hard. They work very hard when they're working. And it's mostly, frankly, pretty, I mean, you're either working in the kitchen or you're cleaning the rooms and so on. But it's a very, and you'll on the weekends, you'll be part of the congregations and so on. And so you're very much involved in the Christian life over there. It really can be a marvelous experience. That's what I was saying. If there are young people who just want 3-6 months away. It's really pretty economic. You just got to get there. After that, you're entirely cared for. You know, so that's what I was thinking of. I try and recruit to that all I can. Anybody else? Question? Yeah. Well, again, I just wrote an article in. I'm sorry. Good point. Question was asked about the age of the Earth and the conflict between the demands of secular or the naturalistic geology that the Earth is millions of years old and so on, as opposed to the testimony of Scripture. I just wrote an article in the magazine, Friends of Israel, magazine Israel My Glory, and I just argued that the literal interpretation of Genesis 1 demands a young earth, and my goodness, I've never gotten such response. Almost still, this was a couple issues ago, but almost every week I get somebody wants to argue with me. Most of them, by the way, are disciples of Hugh Ross. But in short, there are two issues. Number one, you know, folks, there are principles of exegesis which are absolutely necessary. In other words, when we read the Bible, you know, I often tell people, when we read the Bible, the tendency is to read it and ask, now, what does that mean to me? And my response is, shame on you. If you don't, first of all, ask, what does that mean? And what it means is a function of what the original author meant the original readers to understand. Now, that's meaning. Once you establish meaning, then by all means, you should go to the next issue, which is what does it mean to me? And the reason I say that is because the issue of asking what does it mean, and this is what we call hermeneutics, but The process by which you determine that, by which you work your way through the text to understand what the original author intended the original readers to understand and to mean, is called exegesis. And exegesis is the attempt to mine from the Scriptures the original meaning of the original author. And there's only one. One meaning, and it's a fixed meaning. There are these two grand principles of exegesis, and they are authorial intent. See, today, in the modern world, the postmodern world, which is really modernism, you know, the modern rationalism gone nuts, we're told that is the reader who determines the meaning. And at that point, as soon as you buy into this notion that the reader is the primary determiner of meaning, human communication becomes impossible. You can't, there's no use my standing here talking to you if it's up to you to decide what I mean, right? So authorial intent and fixed meaning. If the text can mean, can evolve in its meaning as time goes by, then communication is impossible. And I believe that God created men to know Him, and the primary means by which you know God, that is the primary means by which He has revealed Himself, is human language, and human language is up to the task, and I take it as an article of faith. Now, I get myself excited about that. My point is simply this, that there are some principles by which you can define an exegetical effort which will lead you to the original meaning. You look at the word. You consider how that word is used in its day, how the same author uses those words in other places, what the syntax, the way the language is arranged, says about what that word means. You look at it in its context, both historical context and literary context. All of those things. Now, here's my point. By the issue of what the word day means in Genesis 1 is surrounded by every conceivable exegetical principle. In other words, I'm not saying that well. Whatever set of exegetical principles we can bring to the text to determine its meaning, every single one of them yells at us that this word day. See, because what happens is most people who believe in an ancient earth and want to square it with the Bible will somehow stretch the meaning of the word day. And they'll say, well, the word day can mean different things in different contexts. It can. But that's not to say that it can mean different things in every context. The context demonstrates that it means. Now, that's what I tried to develop briefly in this article. And so I would take it as a matter of interpretive integrity, and I'm putting it on pretty high ground here, so forgive me. But I think as a matter of interpretive integrity, if you're going to be honest with the text, it indicates that God made the earth in six literal days. Now, two things in that regard. We still have the issue of how recent was it? Real quickly, number one, I think there's a theological issue at stake here. If you insinuate the kind of time that is demanded by those who believe that the earth is billions and billions of years old, you have mankind on earth for at least millions and millions of years. During most of that period, God is silent. That makes sense to you? I mean, I think it's a serious thing to suppose that it was only in the last 2,000 years of millions of years in human history, fallen human history, that God began to work redemptively. And once you insinuate time, you have a very, very difficult time making sense of the history of redemption, is what I'm saying. That's kind of a big subject. I won't get into it anymore. But the other thing is, now, I want to distinguish between two things. There are those, I said earlier that I think creation was about 4,000 BC, which means the earth is about 6,000 years old. And as you probably know, the only way to come to that conclusion is to take the Bible at its word with regard to the universal flood, and the effect. Now I'm way above my pay grade here, but the effect that universal flood would have had, and so on, it explains many of the geological phenomena. It certainly explains fossils better than anybody else. There's no other way to really explain fossils other than that sort of a flood geology. But I mentioned before that the way we get to that date is by working our way from 1 Kings 6. I think this may be in your notes, by the way. I think I put it in, and I'm not going to deal with it. Yeah, focus number two is a chronological overview, and I talk about this a little bit. But the 1 Kings 6:1, I mentioned that before. Solomon began to build the temple in his fourth year, began to, which was 480 years after the flood. That gets you back to 1446, 430 years, gets you back to 1876, and then the age of the patriarchs gets you back to Abraham's birth at 2166. Now, from there, to get to creation, you have to go to the genealogies of Genesis 5 and 11. If you add those years up, Adam lived 90-some years and begat Seth. Seth lived X number of years and begat, you know, the next generation. If you add them up, it gets back to about 4,000. There are many young earth creationists, among them John Whitcomb. Do you know that name? John Whitcomb is one of the most important theologians of our era. He's a hero of mine. I cherish the man, but I disagree with him at this point. And by the way, he and a guy named Henry Morris wrote a book called The Genesis Flood that gave birth to the whole creation science movement, and so he's much to be honored. But he argues that there are gaps in those genealogies. And so he will put the age of the earth at about 10,000. That's certainly, and this is entirely a fraternal thing. Amen and amen. Help yourself. I don't believe there are gaps in the genealogies. Now, the Canaan, there are... Canaan. He's the one that's in Luke's is Canaan. There are two or three ways to deal with that, and I'm going to have to beg off. I can point you to that. I don't remember exactly, but that is the problem. One of the big arguments, and that's why I say this is entirely a fraternal discussion. I couldn't get ugly about this. I get ugly about the millions of years of age, but whether or not there are gaps in that genealogy, the big argument is the fact that Luke, in his genealogy of Jesus, includes a man named Canaan who is not in the genealogy of Genesis. There are two or three ways. One of them is that he was not one of the, patriarchs, and that's what Genesis is clearly not tracing every individual. He's tracing the, when one generation would succeed to the next, there would be somebody who would succeed to the place of ruling father, and he's tracing the ruling fathers. So there may be a personage in there that's not one of those ruling fathers. He shows up because he's remembered on another count. It gets kind of technical. Well, now that's the argument for the gaps. Let me explain that, and then I'll come back to that. And I confess, off the top of my head, I don't have a real quick answer for the Canaan thing, though there are two or three answers. But I admit that that is the most significant argument for gaps in the genealogies. I will argue, on the other hand, if you don't mind my saying it ahead of time. Well, no, I'll say it in this order. When I say there are gaps in the genealogies, the idea is that a Hebrew genealogy is designed to demonstrate connectedness, that this generation is, that this person is legitimately a blood descendant of this. And look, my father's name is Dale. My son's name is Jonah. Jonah was born when I was 27. I was born when my dad was about, I'm not sure, but about 30. So let's say if we said that Dale lived to be about 30 and begat Jonah, that would be perfectly legitimate for what a Hebrew genealogy is trying to do. Does that make sense to you? He became the forebear of Jonah. That's what it means. He became the ancestor of Jonah. Now, Doug's in between there, and we just lost 27 years, right? Because I was 27 by the time Jonah was born. But that would be a perfectly legitimate, and that's what it's meant when they say that there are gaps in the genealogy. There are generations left out, and the point is that at this age, he became the ancestor of, but if you've got a generation left out, you lost some time. And so, by that reason, by that configuration of things, and the argument is twofold, basically Canaan and the fact that in Matthew's genealogy, he leaves, when he's given us the genealogy of Jesus, he leaves a couple of generation of kings out, and so, clearly, a genealogy, because it's not supposed to be an absolutely tight record, it's showing connectedness. It's always, you know, genealogies are the bane of Scripture to us. When we get to the genealogies, we're bored out of our, you know, heads, but in Jewish culture, they're hugely important because they do, you always got this issue of inheritance, and it shows connectedness. That's what the genealogy is all about. That's huge. You know, one of the things that I didn't mention earlier, but one of the ways in which the Hebrew, the law, the Torah that God gave is so remarkably gracious is the law of Jubilee. Remember that? Every 50th year, real property returned to the family to whom it originally belonged. That meant one generation couldn't spend the next generation into poverty because every 50th year it was going back. And that's a stroke of genius. I have a friend who about 10 years ago was invited to, they were building a bank in our little town there in Santa Clarita, and they made him the chairman of the bank. I said, Bob, why don't you do that? Stick in the law of Jubilee that every 50th year you contrive debts or cancer. You have to have this paid off. But that's the point. The point was not that, you know, on the 49th year you go out and borrow all the money again. The point was everybody knew by the 50th year you had to settle things. And then, of course, the law of the Sabbath was that every seventh year the debt was suspended. If every seventh year you didn't have to make your house payment, would that be a help to you? You know what I'm saying? You kind of get your feet under you. You get a whole year to get. That's exactly what that's all about. So my point is, by the law of Jubilee, every 50th year, everything reverted, and you had to know who was part of that family. See, so genealogies were hugely important, and they were about showing connectedness. So the point is that there are a couple of indications that there are gaps in some Hebrew genealogies. So the argument is maybe that's what's going on in Genesis 5 and 11. And that's how men like John Whitcomb, who knows a lot more than I do and is huge, I mean, one of my greatest heroes, he argues that creation was about 8 to 10,000 because he's finding gaps. And that's just a total, you know, guess. But he says there are gaps. And so I'm not at all off put by that. I don't think they're there. My big argument, by the way, bro, is that, and I admit, I'm the Canaan thing is the strong. I don't think the Matthew argument is very compelling because of what's going on there. That's right. It adds. It doesn't leave something out. Yeah. And that's the biggest problem. Now, my reply is simply this, that my big argument is this, and I learned this from Harold Honer when I took his class down at Dallas Seminary, but he would argue, look, there is that piece of data. What if it's not there? In other words, it seems like in Genesis 5 and 11, the only genealogies in all the world where you have that little age of each link when he bore the next link, it seems for all the world it's there to help us compute time. And Honer's argument was, if not, what's it there for? Why do we have that if we're not intended to add it up? And by the way, Whitcomb's answer to that is, well, it's God's way of introducing us to this declining age lifespan. But you don't need that because the next phrase goes on to say, and he lived X number of years and died. So the lifespan is defined in the next phrase. Remember that? It says he lived so many years, begat so-and-so, and then he lived so many years, begat sons and daughters, and died. So we have that in the second piece of information. So for what it's worth, I and again, it's entirely a fraternal intramural discussion, this business of the gaps, but I'm of the persuasion that they're not there, but men who are a lot smarter than I are convinced that they are there. Either way, you come out to a young earth as opposed to an ancient earth. It's just young or younger. It's not... Yeah. The billion years are gone. You're only dealing with from 8,000 to 4,000 as a date of creation as opposed to, billions of years. So, and the reason I brought it up is that that's actually the point I wanted to make. We're talking about two very different discussions here. The one discussion... The discussion as to whether or not there are gaps in the genealogies and therefore whether or not creation could be traced to 8,000 or 4,000 B.C. is entirely fraternal. Everybody believes that the Bible is to be taken literally in all of its parts. That's not the issue. When you get into the question of what geology demands and the very, very ancient earth, and I know that there are some believers who argue for this, and I'm quite familiar with most of Hugh Ross's stuff, and he's the one who has argued most vociferously for an ancient earth. By the way, though, I got to say, with regard to Brother Ross, he always, in making that case, insists that the Bible is the less credible to the world because we insist on an ancient earth. I don't believe there is much nobility in the effort to save the Bible from itself. Now, this notion that if we just read the Bible for what it says, it's going to turn people off, and therefore we have to I just don't think the Bible doesn't need rescuing, for heaven's sakes, and so. But those are two very different discussions, if that makes sense to you. Okay, I'm sorry I get into kind of technical stuff that's above my pay grade. Anything else, real quick here? We don't want to be lead, bud. There's only one place the Jews believe they can build a temple. Now, the question was asked, what about the new temple? You're talking about what the Jews are anxious to build today. Let me talk about that real quickly. You probably know that there is in Jerusalem today a temple mount, which is precisely the temple mount from Jesus' day. When Abraham was sent to slay his son Isaac, it says he went to a place called Mount Moriah, Genesis 22. When Solomon built the temple, it says that he built it on Mount Moriah. I think the Bible is rather clear that that is the place to which Abraham went. However you like that, the place, what happened was that there was a little Canaanite city called Jebus, and it remained unconquered all through the days of Joshua. It was conquered temporarily and then went back to the Jebusite. When David became king, he determined to seize that city. It was a remarkable stroke of diplomatic genius because it was right on the border between Judah and Benjamin. So he was a Judahite, but it wasn't in Judah, but it was right on the border. And it was quite central, and it was very, very protectable. In the ancient world, where you build a city is a function primarily of two issues. Number one, water. You got to have water. There's a beautiful spring called the Gihon that dumps tens of thousands of gallons every day out, fresh water. And number two, you got to have defensibility. Jerusalem is built on it's surrounded on three sides by deep valleys. That's how you protect the city. You want hills because you're going to build the wall rather high on the hill, so the enemy has to climb the hill to attack the wall. So David seized Jerusalem, Jebus, it was called Jebus, made it his capital. Later on, he bought a little hill to the north from a man named Araunah. Remember that? And that hill became the Temple Mount. He went and fetched the ark and set it there, and then Solomon built the temple there. And God refers to that again and again as the place where God has... By the way, the name of that hill at the time was Zion. Now, later on, Zion moved. That is, the name now is given to a hill to the west because it was mistaken. When people began to go there, they found this broad hill, and they thought, this must be the place, and they called it Zion. Then later on, they found out they're on the wrong hill. But still, to this day, Zion, when you go to the city of Jerusalem, you'll go to Mount Zion. It's the wrong hill. The hill where the temple sat was Zion. Now, in answer to your question, that is the place where the temple... Now, that Temple Mount was just a little knob of a hill. When Herod remodeled the second temple, the first temple was built by Solomon, destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar in 586. The second temple was built by Zerubbabel, completed in 516, and it was a horribly disappointing thing. The second temple that Zerubbabel built when they came back, this is Ezra 1-6, it was a horribly disappointing thing. I love that verse in Ezra 3 where it says that when they got back, the first thing they had to do was clear the rubble away, and they spent weeks doing that. And then finally they were able to build the foundation and the altar. And when they got that far, they hadn't been able to worship for all of these years. They hadn't been offered all sacrifices. So they offered sacrifices. And the Bible says that many of the people there had been born in Babylon. They had never, ever worshipped God in the Levitical sense. And so now they began to weep. But it says that others who were old enough, call them white hairs, who are old enough to remember Solomon's temple, they compared it to this squatty little temple that they had built. And they too began to weep. And I love Ezra 3:3 says, you couldn't tell who was weeping for joy and who was weeping for sorrow. And that's the whole restoration experience. So much to rejoice in and so much to be disappointed in. But the point is that that second temple, which was so disappointing, was and by the way, all right, this is a lot of Old Testament. That's what we're here for, right? There were two prophets. When they started building that temple, they got careless, and they got consumed with building their own houses. And God raised up two prophets, and their names were Haggai and Zechariah. And they had one job, and that was to get Israel back to the business of building the temple. And they were successful. And Haggai, I always say, was as subtle as a 2x4 upside the head. Remember that? It was Haggai who said, you wonder why you plant much and so little, why you put your money in bags that got holes in it. It's because you're not building, you know, the house of the Lord is lying waste and you're building your own tiled houses. Get up into the hills, get some wood, get down here and build the temple of the Lord. And Zechariah, too, is having all these visions. And Zechariah promises the glory of this house is going to be greater than the glory of the former house. That was a remarkable promise. Well, along comes Herod. And he remodels this second temple. And he makes it into, as a matter of fact, the Talmud says this, see if I can get it right in the first time, that the temple of Herod was as much more beautiful than the temple of Solomon as Solomon's temple was more beautiful than the temple of Zerubbabel. That makes sense to you? And it's in fulfillment of what Zechariah had promised, that the glory of this latter house is going to be greater than the glory of the former house. And so Herod comes along, and in order to do that, he expanded the hill. Now, it's one of the most, you know what? As long as I'm talking about it, in your notes, did I include this? Oh, I probably took it out. I reduced these a little bit so that it wouldn't be so hugely expensive. But, yeah, I did. If you pull down that greater set, which I don't know if it's up yet, but the longer set, it has a picture of the Temple Mount in its expansion. It's really a remarkable piece of engineering. I love to talk about it. But Herod took this little knob of a hill, and he built what is a functional sandbox, or not functional, but it looks like a sandbox, this set of walls all the way around it, and then he built a plaza across the top of it. It's 35 acres. You can get 250,000 people in there all at once, that Temple Mount. It's a beautiful piece of engineering, one of the most amazing pieces of engineering in all the world. Matter of fact, I got to tell you, there's one ashlar. Now, an ashlar is a building block that was carved out of the earth and moved to the place where it's used. And there's an ashlar there, which is probably as long as those first three windows. I mean, it's about that long. It's about 12 feet high. It weighs 600 tons. We could not put it where it is today. Herod moved it there. I stood next to a guy, a good friend from Seattle. His name was Rick, and he'd spent his whole life. We were there, you know, he was on a tour I was with him. And he spent his whole life, he was one of the greatest crane operators in the world. He went all over the world training people how to do the next. And I said to him, Rick, do we have a crane that could move that from the quarry to this place? And he said, if I had two cranes, I could position it. But I could not move it from one place. I have no idea how we could do it. Herod did it. I mean, it was an amazing piece of engineering, that whole Temple Mount, which still stands there. Now, you remember, the temple was destroyed. The whole temple was swept into the valley. But the Temple Mount is still there. On that Temple Mount are two Muslim holy places. The one is called the Dome of the Rock. It's the one you see, the eight-sided golden dome with the tile and so on. The other is called the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's the Al-Aqsa Mosque is the more important of the two. The Dome of the Rock is called that because it sits right on top of the rock where the Holy of Holies was. Now, there used to be some question about this. There is a man, a remarkable man named Lane Rittmeyer, who in the last 20 years has done remarkable work, and he has demonstrated. Matter of fact, I can tell you what he did. And it's today you can't see that rock. I mean, you could if you get inside, but you can't go inside. You used to be able to. I used to go in there when I go, but now with all the present trouble, you can't go in there. And he did all of this work, and he had to do it with photographs, where he did all of this work on that rock. It's an outcropping of rock. It's the highest rock on this. Again, you got to understand, you're walking around in this plaza, which has been built over the mountain, but the mountain sticks up right there, and it's this little outcropping of rock. And he showed how there's a cut on one side and a cut on another that's not as deep, but both of them are exactly the width of the Holy of Holies. And right in the middle between those two, there's a place where the rock has clearly been scraped level. It's been cut level. And as he measured that, he determined that it was exactly the width of the Ark of the Covenant. It was exactly the place where it would have sat. And he was a little troubled because it's kind of a little ledge that's cut into the face of the rock. But it's exactly the same width as the Ark of the Covenant, but it's a little deeper than the Ark of the Covenant. And he wondered why that was. And then he noticed the verse in Deuteronomy where God tells Moses to take the books of the law and to lay them before the Lord in the Holy of Holies. And so he argues that that's the little shelf that was the original Torah scrolls were laid there and kept there. So I think there's really compelling evidence that that is exactly the place. Now, you ask the question, how are they going to build it? The Jews, and you know what? I believe so strongly, folks, that Jesus is coming soon. I know that's easy to say. And I know that every generation of believers has believed that same thing. And I believe that God has crafted human history in such a way that every generation of believers had good reason to believe that it could happen, probably would happen in their lifetime. And let me just say, I think the most wicked thing we could do is to conclude that because every other generation was believed, it was coming soon. That probably not coming. That's 2 Peter 3:9. That's to fall prey to that sin. But my point is this, that one of the things that is I find the most compelling is that throughout most of Jewish history, there have been two predominant mentalities within the Jewish world. The one is Orthodox Jewry, practicing Jews, serious Jews, religious Jews. And there are three basic boundary markers, as they're called today, which identify serious Jews. See, Judaism, through most of its history, was a function of obedience to the Levitical system. But in 70 AD, their temple was destroyed. They never had one since. They consciously, at a place called Jamnia, redefined Judaism. Herman Woke says that they took a religion which had been a religion of the feet and the hands, in other words, you walk to the temple, you offer, and they made it a religion of the head and the heart. And the three great portable distinctions of Judaism since 70 AD, in other words, you could do these anywhere, are circumcision of your male children, Shabbat, and kashrut, kosher. You eat kosher. And all through post-70 AD Jewish history, religious, rabbinical, practicing Orthodox, and Orthodox Jews don't have to have the earlocks and they can look very, I met a man, I deliberately went to the airport to meet him, serious Orthodox Jew, he had some things we wanted to talk about. And he looked like, he had a keep on, but otherwise he looked like anybody else in the airport, you know, but he was a serious Orthodox Jew. Now, the point is you've had Orthodox Jews, and then you've had non-religious, basically atheistic, secularized Jews. The thing is, neither of those, in most of Israel's history, since the destruction of the temple, has been interested in rebuilding a temple. Because the Orthodox Jews have always insisted that that's the business of the Messiah. And it's wicked for us to try and do that. When Messiah comes, Zechariah chapter 6, or chapter 3, he will build the temple. It's the branch, it's the Messiah who will build the temple, and we got no business doing it. And then you have the secular Jews, and they're saying that is the fuse on the bomb that's going to set off the Third World War. We don't want anything to do it. We don't care anything about it. About 20 years ago, a group, there were actually two groups, and they don't get along so well, as is usually the case, but both of them are convinced that they're called the Temple Faithful and the, what's the other one? It'll come to me, but the Temple Faithful and one other group. And they're both convinced, they have convinced themselves, that it is the Messiah who will build the temple, but all he's waiting for is an expression of faith on the part of the Jewish people that could be best expressed by laying the foundation. If they would simply lay the foundation in that moment, Messiah would come and complete the work. And so they began to mount an effort to lay. Now, can you imagine? To haul a foundation stone up on the Temple Mount. I mean, they actually cut the stone, and they petitioned the government for permission, and the government laughed in their face and said, you know, what have you been smoking? Forgive me. And so, but on a certain day, they hauled it out, and there was a big riot, and 18 people were killed, and so they made them put it back in a warehouse, and now every year they get it out again, and there's this minor riot, and so on, they put it back in a warehouse. And they're doing everything they can to prepare for the building of the temple. They're trying to do everything, thinking that they can actually motivate Messiah to come by this expression of confidence that it's going to happen. And they're recruiting people to train. Eric, back there, what's your last name, Eric? I'm sorry. Is it Cohen? C-O-H-E-N? Ian, what is that? Do you know, Eric? That's right, the Kohen, the priests. And if you wanted to, Eric, they would take you under their wing and they would train you at their expense to be a priest. That's all they need. Now, your Christian testimony might get in the way if it came out, but the fact of the matter is that they are recruiting people who are named Levi or Cohen or Khan, Levi the tribe, Cohen the name priest, and so on. And they are training them. They have all the accoutrements. They have a huge menorah that they've crafted. And they've done it all according to Levitical prescriptions. And they have a shop there in Jerusalem, and it's a nice shop. I always tell people I don't shop there because there's a sign on the wall that says all proceeds will be given. We'll go to fashion, you know, implements for the what they call the third temple. Well, I think that's Antichrist temple, and I don't want some plaque in there. It says Doug Bookman gave money. You know, so I refused to give money. But the point is, now let me just say this real quickly. I believe there are going to be four temples. There has been a first. There has been a second. There is a third coming. It's going to be Antichrist temple. Folks, you have. This is not what I'm here to talk about this week, but I love to talk about it if you can't tell. You have in the Bible a very careful description of the end time drama. Central to that drama is an apostate temple that Antichrist is going to seize for himself and demand worship of himself. There is going to be a third temple. That temple will be destroyed and replaced, praise God, by a fourth temple from which Messiah will rule in Jerusalem in a refashioned Jerusalem according to the book of Ezekiel. Now, back to your question. The question is, how in the world is Israel going to be able to build a temple? There are those who believe that the Dome of the Rock is misplaced and that the actual temple sat a little bit to the north around a place called the Dome of the Tablets, and they will argue that they could just build a wall and you could have a temple on one side and the mosque, the Dome of the Rock, on the other. I do not believe that the Dome of the Rock is misplaced. I think it is built over the place. I will say that if Antichrist can talk people into the world, into that, maybe that's the way it'll happen. But I would submit on the basis of Daniel 9 that the stroke of diplomatic genius, which is going to be primarily, is going to be the primary factor in catapulting this individual, whoever he is, into world prominence that we know of as Antichrist. In other words, that which will give Antichrist the power that he possesses in the Scripture will be his solving of the question, how can we allow the Jews? He's going to somehow cut that Gordian, he's going to square that circle. Now, why do I say that? Because in Daniel 9, we are told that Antichrist, the prince, will make a covenant with Israel. Now, it's the many there, but I think in context it's Israel, for 1 week. We're never told what that treaty will be. But in the next verse, it says, in the middle of the week, he will break the covenant, causing the sacrifices and oblations to cease. So if breaking the covenant causes it to cease, it seems to me reasonable to argue that the cutting of the covenant will be, and I'm telling you, what could be more pertinent to the world in which we live? Remember Bill Clinton, in the waning days of that sorry administration, trying to restore some sort of legacy by you know, solving the Arab/Jewish problem over there, and that is the gut-wrenching problem of our this era. And I think Antichrist will probably, I think they will build a temple. I think they will build it. This is the scenario I put together, and this is a lot to lay on you, but you do what you will with it. This is eschatology, but I think. I do not believe the rapture begins the 70th week. I think the rapture will happen, and in the disarray and confusion of the rapture, that Antichrist will be thrust into worldwide prominence, and from that position, he will work out this riddle. He'll solve this riddle. Somehow he'll provide a way through diplomacy or whatever it is, force, by which the Jews will be allowed. And when he signs that covenant, that's when a seven-year clock begins to tick. And in the course of that, and so I think very, very pivotal to the Antichrist's being thrust into worldwide power will be the so I don't think it's going to happen. I think we're going to witness it from a heavenly grandstand, as it were. I think, I know there's a lot of questions about that, and this is one of those very, very fraternal intramural discussions and so on. This is all among believers. But I do believe in a pre-tribulation rapture, and I believe that it will precipitate the series of events by which Antichrist will be thrust into power, and from that place of power he will make that covenant. So, and I think it's going to be right in that spot. I think it's going to be right where the Dome of the Rock is. The Dome of the Rock has to come down in order for there to be. Now, are you guys familiar? And then I'm done. I know it's late, and you guys are starting to wear out, and so am I. But do you read Joel Rosenberg? You know. Do you? Yeah, the Epicenter's good. Rosenberg's pretty. I think he's helpful. Rosenberg is a converted Jew. He was raised in a Jew. He's second generation Messianic Jew, but he's the guy who made a name for himself because he began to anticipate what was going to happen in the Arab world on the basis of his reading of Ezekiel 38 and 39. And he has argued very, very convincingly, I think, for some of these things. If you take a pre-tribulation, you know, a thoroughly literalist reading of Revelation and so on, he's done so. And his flash traffic is well worth reading. So I don't know if you're interested in these things. This is extra. You guys have been very patient. I won't usually be this long, but let's go home. Is that all right?
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. I'm having all the fun up here. Thank you so much, you guys.